You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Recent research suggests that there is one common origin for the Trans-Eurasian language family, which includes Japanese and Turkish dialects. Despite the general view that these languages are independent, the study claims they come from millet farmers who lived in northeastern China around 9,000 years ago. I spoke to the lead author, Dr. Martin Robitz, who is a comparative linguist at the University of Mainz and the Max Planck Institute for Science of Human History. We talked about a bunch of different things to do with the study, including the origin and spread of these languages, as well as its impacts on national identities. I began by asking for a general overview of the findings.
So yes, my field of study are the Trans-Eurasian languages, and we use this term Trans-Eurasian in reference to a large group of geographically adjacent languages that reach all the way from the Pacific in the east to the Baltic, the Mediterranean, and the Black Sea in the west. And they include up to five different non-controversial linguistic families that are the Turkic languages, the Mongolic languages, the Tungusic languages spoken in northern Siberia, and then Korean and Japonic, that is not only Japanese, but also the languages of the Ryukyuan Islands. And the very question whether these five different linguistic groupings go back to one single common ancestor is one of the most disputed issues in historical linguistics. And in my past research, actually over the last 20 years, I found evidence, but only a small core of reliable evidence, to support the genealogical relatedness of these languages. But then, if we accept that these languages are really related, new questions arise, such as who were the ancestral speakers to these languages? Where did they live? Where did they go? When did they move? And why did they move? And these are questions that we cannot answer with linguistics alone. And that's why we kind of integrated archaeology and genetics into the picture.
And I guess your research obviously linked these languages back to millet farmers back in ancient times. Could you elaborate on this a little bit more? What is this linkage? How did it come about?
When we were studying our languages, we basically compared all 98 Trans-Eurasian languages. We compiled a big database, and then we applied different linguistic techniques to this database. And like that, we found out that the so-called homeland of these languages was in northeast China, in the West Liao River region. We also found that they dated back about 9,000 years ago. And exactly 9,000 years ago in the West Liao River region, we know that there was a domestication center of millet agriculture in Northeast Asia. So that's where the millet farmers first developed. And that's why we linked, so to say, the origins of this language to the origins or the beginnings of millet agriculture in Northeast China.
Specifically, yeah. who are these millet farmers? Is there information about what kind of people these could be?
We find information on different levels. On the linguistic level, we examined the reconstruction. So we try to reconstruct words to Trans-Eurasian, and we assumed that if the people had those words, they were also familiar with the practices. So for instance, we could reconstruct words for field, for broom corn millet, for a complex textile technology like spinning and weaving, for fermentation. So all these words reconstructed, we could tell something about the original culture. That is, we think the original speakers of Trans-Eurasian were sedentary. They were farmers. They concentrated on millet farmer. We do not find any evidence for rice or barley or wheat in the vocabulary, so only millet farming probably. And then we know that these people preserved food by fermentation, and that they engaged in complex textile technology, for instance, spinning and weaving.
And has this information just come about from analyzing linguistics, or is it from archaeological stuff and other things as well?
Exactly. So that's what we found in the linguistics. But then In the archaeological part of the project, we did another study. The basic logic actually that underlies our study is that each discipline should work independently from each other. In that way, we avoid circularity in the reasoning. So in the archaeological part of the project, we collected information about 255 Neolithic and Bronze Age sites in the region, West Liao River region, Russian Far East, Korea, and Japan. And we compared all different features of these sites. And basically, we found that millet agriculture originated in the West Liao River region in Northeast China, and that it first went to Korea, the Korean Peninsula, around 6,000 years ago. And then a millennium later, it went to the Russian Far East. And around 3,000 years ago, rice was integrated in the millet agricultural package. And rice was brought from the Liaodong and the Shandong peninsulas over Korea to Japan, where it probably led not only to the adoption of rice and millet agriculture in Japan in the Bronze Age, but also to the adoption of Japanese language. So we find that the dispersal of millet and rice mirrors the dispersal of our languages in time and space. We also had a genetic part in our project. So we collected ancient DNA for the same region. We sampled several new samples of ancient DNA, so newly collected samples, and we combined them with already existing analysis of ancient DNA.
The information that you found, especially given it's assuming that transduration languages are from one common origin, and I understand there's a lot of dispute over where these languages come from, whether they're independent. How does this, I guess, change the assumptions we have of these languages and the cultures of transduration people?
I must say that in my past research, I have studied that transduration question for a long time. So initially, when I was doing my PhD, I thought that the Trans-Eurasian languages were not related. So I tried very hard to do my best to show why they were not related. But in the end, I was left with a small core of evidence, about 300 etymologies that could not be rejected for whatever reason. So I put them in a kind of sound matrix, checking whether they displayed regular sound correspondences. And it turned out that 300 of these etymologies indeed displayed regular sound correspondences. This criterion of having regular sound correspondence is the basic requirement of the method of the historical comparative method in historical linguistics. So that's why in the first place, for on the basis of the words, word comparison, I thought, well, yes, these Trans-Eurasian languages seem to be related. And then later in my career, in my research, I also looked at other things like morphology, that are little building stones of words, which I compared, and like that in the end.
If these languages are related that you're suggesting, does that change the way that we think about Japanese or Korean or similar cultures?
I think it has an impact in the sense that what we do is we lay the origins of the languages, the genes, the people, and the culture. We situate them beyond the present day national boundaries of these countries. That is a kind of surrender of identity that many of these people are not prepared to take or to do yet. I think that that is also understandable, and we should respect that. Until now, the history of Japan and Korea has always been studied within the national borders, and now suddenly we're suggesting like an origin that lies further than that. And I think that for bigger nations like, or powerful nations like Japan and Korea and China, we see that they often represent their people as having one genetic profile, one language, and one culture. But a truth that makes many people with nationalistic agendas a bit uncomfortable is that all languages, all people, and all cultures are mixed in the end, including those in Asia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.